It's good to see you all here this morning.
I know my brother has spent many hours in preparation to be an instrument in God's hands. I ask that you would give him your careful and your prayerful attention to our brother Dwayne.
Thank you, Bob. It is good to see each one of you here this morning. Good to be here with you. This morning, I want to start by looking at some things that have happened in the past. Some things throughout history that have happened to the wicked and to the righteous. And we'll see as we go along here how God has dealt with these things in the past. Let's start out in Genesis chapter 6. Now we're going to read verses 3 through 14. And the Lord said, "My spirit will not always strive with man, for that he also is flesh, yet his days shall be 120 years. This is important to understand that it says, "My spirit will not always strive with man." If man resists the spirit of the Lord, if he quenches the spirit of the Lord, if he strives against that spirit of the Lord, eventually there comes a time when God will no longer strive with them because they have become corrupt, they have become carnal, they have become sensual. They have turned their back on God. Hold your places there, but let's go over to 2 Nephi, chapter 11, verses 76 through 77. And this is on page 145. We'll see where the Lord has some very similar words here. Verses 76 and 77. "For because they yield unto the devil and choose works of darkness rather than light, therefore they must go down to hell. For the Spirit of the Lord will not always strive with man." We see this same phrase here, that the Spirit of the Lord will not always strive with man. And we see what the consequences of this are, don't we? It says that they will go down to hell. They will be condemned. "And when the spirit ceases to strive with man, then come a speedy destruction, and this grieveth my soul." This is a warning to everyone that if we are not trying to be righteous, not trying to serve God, that this is what eventually happens, that God will not strive with these people. So let's go back here to Genesis chapter 6. And we'll start there on verse 4. "There were giants in the earth in those days, and also after that, when the sons of God came in unto the daughters of men, and they bare children to them. And the same became mighty men which were of old, men of renown. And God saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and that every imagination of the thoughts of the heart was only evil continually." The people had become wicked, greatly wicked, and God had had enough, hadn't he? He was no longer going to strive with these people. Verse 6, "And it repented the Lord that he had made man on the earth, and it grieved him at his heart. And the Lord said, I will destroy man whom I have created from the face of the earth, both man and beast and the creeping thing and the fowls of the air, for it repenteth me that I made them." God is going to destroy them, except for just a few. "But Noah found grace in the eyes of the Lord. These are the generations of Noah. Noah was a just man and perfect in his generations. And Noah walked with God. Noah was a righteous, godly man. And Noah begat three sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. The earth also was corrupt before God, and the earth was filled with violence. And God looked upon the earth, and behold, it was corrupt, for all flesh had corrupted his way upon the earth. And God said unto Noah, the end of all flesh is come before me. For the earth is filled with violence through them, and behold, I will destroy them with the earth. Make thee an ark of gopher wood. Room shalt thou make in the ark, and shalt pitch it within and without with pitch. So God had had enough of this wicked people, and he was going to destroy them. But we have Noah, a man who walked with God and his family. And God comes to Noah and tells him to build an ark. Let's keep your places. We're going to come back here. But let's go over to Hebrews chapter 11, verses 6 and 7. But without faith it is impossible to please him. For he that cometh to God must believe that he is, and that he is a rewarder of them that diligently seek him. We see this is one of the requirements of us, that we must have faith in God. Verse 7. By faith Noah, being warned of God of things not seen as yet, moved with fear, prepared an ark to the saving of his house, by the which he condemned the world and became heir of righteousness, which is by faith. Do you think it took great faith for Noah to build that ark on dry land? Do you ever think about that? Can you imagine the ridicule that he got? You know how people are. You know, they like to pick on you, and especially when you're doing something that seems a little silly, or you don't think people came by and said, "Hey, Noah, what you got going there?" I'm sure it was continual. But Noah had faith. He believed in God. He feared God. He had respect for God. He honored God. He had awe for God. He knew that God was almighty. He followed God's commandments. He feared God, and he had faith in God. You know, in our lives, as time goes on, we may have some of these things that we may be required to do that's going to go against the norm. In our spiritual lives, we need to be doing that every day, don't we? That really goes against the norm. That goes against what is accepted by man today, but is against the law of God. We may be persecuted for these things. It may test our faith. But we need to be strong in these things. Let's go back to Genesis. Let's go over one chapter, to chapter 7. And let's read verse 13. And we see here that we didn't read this, but Noah has built the ark and gathered the animals as he was commanded by God. God gave him the blueprint. He told him how to do this. He didn't just say, "Noah, go out and build me an ark." He gave him the plan. He gave them the instructions. Just like God will always do with us in our spiritual life. He will give us the plan. He will give us the instructions that we need if we will seek him. In the selfsame day entered Noah and Shem and Ham and Japheth, the sons of Noah, and Noah's wife, and the three wives of his sons with them into the ark. Eight people. Eight people and the animals were all that was saved. Let's go down and read verse 21 through 23. And all flesh died that moved upon the earth, both of fowl and of cattle and of beast and of every creeping thing that creepeth upon the earth, and every man, all in whose nostrils was the breath of life, of all that was in the dry land died. Every living thing that was on the dry land died, except what was in that ark. And every living substance was destroyed, which was upon the face of the ground, both man and cattle and the creeping things and the fowls of heaven. And they were destroyed from the earth, and Noah only remained alive, and they that were with him in the ark. God no longer strived with these men, did he? He did not strive with the world any longer. They had become wicked and corrupt, except for these eight souls. That's hard to imagine, isn't it? That there was only eight righteous people in all the world. But we see what God did here. He preserved the righteous, and he destroyed the wicked. Keep that in mind as we go on. That pattern will be through eternity. It applies to us today. Let's turn over to 2 Peter, chapter 2, verses 4 through 9. For if God spared not the angels that sinned, but cast them down to hell and delivered them into chains of darkness to be reserved unto judgment. We see this began from the beginning, didn't it? God's judgment. We know that a third of the host of heaven, a third of the angels fell and went with Satan. They were wicked. But he cast them down to hell. Verse 5, and spared not the old world, but saved Noah, the eighth person, a preacher of righteousness, bringing in the flood upon the world of the ungodly. Which we just read that story. And turning the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah into ashes, condemned them with an overthrow, making them an example unto those that after should live godly. We see that God destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah when they became ripe with iniquity. He destroyed those people. And we see what it says here in the last half of this verse. It's important. Remember this. It says, it's an example unto those that after should live ungodly. That is what's going to happen to everyone that lives ungodly, without exception. No matter what time they live in, from the beginning to the end. That is the example. Verse 7, and delivered just Lot, vexed with the filthy conversation of the wicked. For that righteous man dwelling among them, in seeing and hearing, vexed his righteous soul from day to day from their unlawful deeds. The Lord knoweth how to deliver the godly out of temptations and to reserve the unjust unto the day of judgment to be punished. These are important words. It says, the Lord knoweth how to deliver the godly out of temptations. He knows what we need. He knows how to deliver us from these things. Those things are available to us. They're available to the world. There is a plan there where everyone can be saved. But that's up to each one of us. If we approach God and seek this plan that He has, how He can deliver us out of temptations. Because we know this world is full of temptations, and it's only going to get worse. But God is there for the righteous. Now let's look at some things that are going to happen in the future. Some things that have been prophesied of, some things that are going to happen to the wicked, and things that are going to happen to the righteous. And as we talk about this being the future, some of these things are today. It's this generation. It's the very near future. It's not thousands of years off. We know that when the disciples were with Christ and they were talking to Him, they were looking for His return in their lifetime, weren't they? But that's been 2,000 years ago. But I think this is the last generation. I think there are those in this room who will still be living here when Christ returns. So the time is short. The time is near. A lot of these things we're talking about are this generation. Let's turn over to Matthew chapter 24, verses 21 through 24. This 24th chapter, if we'd go back to verse 3, I mean, the disciples are asking Christ, you know, and it says, and He sat upon the Mount of Olives. The disciples came unto Him privately, saying, tell us, when shall these things be, and what shall be the sign of Thy coming and of the end of the world? So the disciples are asking Christ about these things. You know, what are going to be the signs? What do we need to look for? And this is some of the things that Christ said. Verse 21. For then shall be great tribulation, such as was not since the beginning of the world, to this time, no, nor ever shall be. We see that there will be great tribulation like that there has never been before. And we can remember what happened in Noah's time, can't we? That all but eight were destroyed because of the wickedness of the world. But this is going to be greater tribulation. A warning to us. And except those days should be shortened, there should no flesh be saved. But for the elect's sake, those days shall be shortened. So it sounds like if God allowed this world to continue past a certain time, that all would be destroyed. None would be saved. But for the elect's sake, God is going to shorten those days before it gets so bad that none could be saved. Then, if any man shall say unto you, lo, here is Christ, or there, believe it not. For there shall arise false Christs and false prophets, and shall show signs of great, and shall show sign great signs and wonders, insomuch that if it were possible, they shall deceive the very elect. That's kind of where we're at right now. We're at the beginning of these things. They're going to increase, but there are false prophets and there are false teachers that are trying to lead away man today through the power of Satan. We need to be aware of these and watch out for these. Because we know that Satan is so subtle. He brings these things in that just is a little something, a little innocent thing, you know, that is, you know, it can't mean anything. It can't be bad. But as we read on here, we're going to see how these things are deceiving the world as we speak. They are leading people away. They are leading them away to destruction. We know that these things are coming upon the earth. And we need to think about our spiritual lives and where we are at. Where we are at today. As we're preparing for these things, as we know that these things, as time goes on, are going to get worse. So I have a question for you. Are we complacent? And more importantly, maybe, individually, am I complacent? Or am I complacent sometimes? Because that may be all it takes, is to be complacent sometimes when this seed can be planted by Satan that can lead us away to destruction. Let's look at the definition of complacent. It's pleased, especially with oneself or one's merits, advantages, situations, etc., often without awareness of some potential danger, defect, or the like. It is self-satisfied. Self-satisfied. Are we satisfied with where we're at in our spiritual lives? I hope not, because we always need to be improving. As time goes on, we're going to have to be stronger. There's great danger in this. We can't be complacent in our lives. We must always be alert. And not allow Satan to lead us away. Because he is out there every day trying to deceive us. And sometimes just these little things can gradually lead us away. I just have one little example here. Of church attendance. We never have as many people here on Wednesday night, do we? And I know sometimes there may be reasons. But the question is are we not here because we're being complacent? that we have something more important to do, or it's not important to us. Or maybe something that's not quite as important, but for some reason we seem to dress more casual on Wednesday night, don't we? We dress more casual on Wednesday night than we do Sunday morning. Why is that? Are we being complacent? Is Wednesday not quite as important as Sunday? Why is that? Are we not expecting as much? Are we not expecting the Lord to be there on Wednesday like we do on Sunday morning? I know a Wednesday night service, a Wednesday night song service, is when I was called into the ministry. Was the Lord there that night? Yeah, He was there that night. Was that service important to God? Yeah, it was important to God. Was it important to me? Yeah, it was important to me. It was important to my brother Bob. He was called to be an elder that same night. A little thing. Are we going to be condemned for not dressing as nice on Wednesday as we are on Sunday? I'm not saying that. It's these little things that over time can lead us away. Little things. My grandmother was born in 1900. From 1920, when she was 20 years old, if she would come here today, she's been dead for quite a few years, and see some of the little things that we do that we don't think about anymore, she would be appalled, wouldn't she? The little things that we have accepted. We have to be careful and not be complacent that these little things that seem so innocent can lead us away. And some of these little things may not lead us away, but sometimes we don't know if we're going to be the one that's going to get led away because of that little thing. When we're complacent, it leaves an opening for Satan. It leaves a door open. Those people in Noah's time, do you think they were complacent? Absolutely. They were complacent. They were self-satisfied. They were living their life. They could care less about anything. They could care less what Noah said or about that silly ark he was building. They were deceived by Satan. And we know what the end result was, don't we? Let's turn over to 1 Peter chapter 5, verse 8. Be sober, be vigilant, because your adversary, the devil, as a roaring lion, walketh about seeking whom he may devour. He is out there trying to devour each one of us. It says to be sober, be vigilant. We need to be watchful. We need to be on guard at all times. We need to be alert. We need to be awake. We need to take it serious. Very serious. Because, believe me, when we leave the door open, just a crack, what's going to happen? Satan's in there just like that. Once he gets in, might be hard to get rid of him, huh? It's like you leave the door open just a little bit and a mouse comes in. Hard to get rid of him, isn't it? Especially if you have to just try to catch him. We see things happening in the world today. And I'm going to read you some examples here where the world is trying to change Christ. They're trying to lower his standard. They're trying to defame him. They're trying to say that he's not the Son of God. These are these little things that are really becoming big things that are deceiving people and leading them away. The Da Vinci Code. You would about have to be under a rock to not have heard about this movie. It is everywhere. They're talking about it. They've been talking about it for months. The book came out several years ago. I read that they sold like 40 million copies of the book. And the one place I read that the 60 million people have read this book. The movie started last week, maybe 2 weeks ago now. People are talking about it, aren't they? Everywhere, people are talking about this, the Da Vinci Code. And they've got in this, they've got, and I just know a little bit about it. But I'll tell you that. They got a conspiracy theory. And this theory was that Christ was married to Mary Magdalene and fathered a daughter whose bloodline has survived into present-day Europe. This is part of what they're portraying in this movie and in this book. And one reporter asked the cast if they believed Christ was married. Now, these are the people that are in this movie and are portraying this. And one of the cast quipped, he says, "Well, I wasn't around." Just so flippant. In other words, I wasn't there when 2,000 years ago. Just doesn't want to deal with it. He probably doesn't really believe that. But he is portraying that in a movie. I want to read you some articles, some little excerpts of some articles. And I'm just going to pick up in the middle. So Jones notes that the Da Vinci Code doesn't only attack Catholicism, but all of Christianity. Really, any sort of Christian would have to say, if anything this book says is true, then my faith is based on a lie, he said. The whole claim that the whole divinity of Christ was made up in the 4th century by Constantine, that's the most ridiculous thing in the world. Davern offers a standard response to question about the Da Vinci Code. It's fiction. If you stop and you think about it, it strains the credibility of any thinking person to think of it as anything but a good yarn. They're portraying it to be fiction. You cannot degrade or blaspheme or Christ and just say, "I just wrote a fiction book." It doesn't work that way. You are going to deceive many people by writing something like that or being an actor on the screen and portraying that person. You can't just say, "Oh, it's just fiction." It doesn't work that way. They have sinned against Christ. It's not just fiction. The story may be fiction, but you can't write something like that and spread it all over the world and just pretend like it's no big deal. It is a big deal. It's deceiving people. I can assure you there will be many people deceived from this. I think that the movie, I think the first week it made like $250 million worldwide. So you think people are going to see the movie? The Da Vinci Code is laughable from start to finish, a comedy of errors that defies serious reading, but the impact of the story is sometimes is something else altogether. Wayak believes that the popular appeal of the book underscores the failure of the organized church to adequately educate its followers. People are looking for something else, aren't they? They're not satisfied with the truth. They're looking for something else. I don't think the Da Vinci Code is an attack on the church, Sarno said. I think it's a great novel, and I found very gripping and interesting to read. I couldn't put it down. He emphasized, however, that it should be seen simply as fiction. It is the inability of too many readers and moviegoers to make that distinction. That alarms priests. Younger generations especially aren't strong enough in knowledge of their faith. The church fears to separate truth from fable. That kind of sums it up right there. That's the problem. People aren't going to be able to separate this because so many of these people that are seeing this, they don't have a faith anyway. They don't have a strong faith. You know, they don't, you know, it was Christ the Son of God. Well, it's, you know, I don't know. I've kind of heard that. They don't have a strong belief in that. So they hear something like this and they say, oh, that sounds pretty good. You know, let's run with that. Here's another one of the actresses that starred in this show. She had a Catholic school education that says her religious beliefs now are lazy. I have faith, but it's not focused on the Bible. Whatever that is. So the theories the book spins about the origins of Christianity, and particularly the notion that Jesus Christ and Mary Magdalene may have been married and had a child, did not bother her the way it does many Christians. Didn't make any difference to her. She didn't really believe much to begin with. The possibility that Jesus was a family man is one of the many intriguing speculations out of Christian history, such as whether the Immaculate Conception was real or whether Christ was an only child, she said. Given the book's popularity, she figures it's a small minority that took offense. We've been talking about this controversy, and I haven't seen anything. I think it's just a few little people, very radical, who speak very loudly, she says. Little people that speak, radicals, that are going to oppose this book. Here's a cartoon that was in the paper. You know, it says the Da Vinci Code. Of course, it shows Mona Lisa. And she's got a little smirk on her face there. And written across her lips, it says, it's just a movie. It's not just a movie. Jesus has always been able to move product, especially books. On average, every 1.6 seconds, a new English language Bible is purchased. I'm surprised that they're selling that many Bibles, to be honest. But as you read on, you'll see probably why they're buying them. Joel Osteen's Good News philosophy just earned him a multi-million-dollar book contract. And Rick Warren's The Purpose-Driven Life with the message, Serve Jesus, has sold almost six times as many books as the South Beach Diet, which message is, Serve High-Fiber Foods. So people are buying Bibles. Or of some form of a Bible or some self-help thing. Jay's talked about these self-help things, you know. What's curious is how many of the Jesus books, these that are being sold every 1.6 seconds, how many of these Jesus books reject or revise Bible teachings? I'll bet if you'd look and see how many of those are King James Bibles, you'd probably find they're sold one a day or something, you know, instead of 1.6 seconds. It's these other things that people are looking for. Books reject or revise Bible teachings and pose radically different versions of Jesus' story. They're changing the truth. Books on the extended New York Times bestseller list posted that Jesus survived his crucifixion. That's in the Jesus Papers. Judas' betrayal was a collaboration with Jesus. The Gospel of Judas, the last gospel. John the Baptist was a twin Messiah. The Jesus dynasty. And Jesus' words have been grossly misinterpreted. The misquoting Jesus Bible. Or whatever it is. This doesn't include the Holy Mother of all Jesus revisionism books, the Da Vinci Code, which says Jesus married Mary Magdalene and sired a baby. Alternative versions of Jesus are not new. Listen to what used to happen to these people. The earliest Christian movements were riven with competing understandings of what Jesus meant, and the generally accepted gospel story has always contended with rival interpretations. In antiquity, the authors were burned as heretics. Now they get hefty book deals. These books are rising with a general boom in religious book sales. The fallout from 9/11, the political power of the religious right, and broader retail availability of these books have combined to produce perfect storm for religion books. That's especially true now for books about Jesus, reflecting a continuing fascination with figuring out who he really was. See, people, so many people don't have it in their minds who he really was. They're still trying to figure out who he was. So anytime there's a Da Vinci Code, they think, well, that sounds good. Well, that must be who he was. But a BeliefNet.com poll suggests another possible explanation for why readers are fascinated by alternative Christian histories. They suspect that Christianity, as currently practiced, is not exactly what Jesus intended. Asked whether Jesus would be happy with modern Christianity, only 15% in the BeliefNet poll said yes. Of course, respondents differed over why Jesus would be disappointed. 19% said he'd think the modern church was too liberal. 24% said he'd think it was too conservative. 7% said we're neglecting the poor, 11% that we're focused too much on worldly matters, and 23% that Jesus didn't intend to start a new religion at all. Either way, believers agree that something went awry and that he wouldn't be happy about it. Here's a few more. The Gospel of Judas, we talked a little bit about that. The Gospel tells us that Judas was Jesus' only true disciple, to whom he imparted secret mystic knowledge, and whom he asked to turn him in to the Romans in order to free his spirit from its fleshly prison. You see, it says here, a secret mystic knowledge. You know, mystic is the occult. So this is appears to be tying into Satan here somehow. We have the second discourse of Great Seth. It says that the true Christ was never crucified. The Gospel of Thomas. Mary and another woman, Salome, are one of six, not 12, true disciples. The Gospel of Mary reveals secrets Jesus gave to Mary Magdalene alone and not his male disciples. It depicts Mary as a leader of Jesus' followers in the days after his resurrection. Jesus, she says, has appeared to her in a vision where he gave her special knowledge of the soul's journey through mystical realms. She tells the men she will help them understand the true teachings of Christ. What is hidden from you, I shall reveal to you. To many feminists and theological liberals, the Gospel of Mary suggests that the Magdalene, the first witness to the resurrection, was the apostle of the apostles, a figure with equal or even favored status to the men around Jesus, a woman so threatening that the apostles suppressed her role and those of other women in a bid to build a patriarchal hierarchy in the early church. Those are just some of the things. I'm sure if you would read all of these modern interpretations of the Bible, I'm sure they're just full of this stuff. Just full of it. But these things are out there. They're tools of Satan. It's these seeds that Satan is planting to try to deceive people. And it's working, isn't it? It's working out there today. We need to be careful. We need to be aware. We need to be watchful. We need to be alert. We need to be serious. Because we're going to see more and more and more of this. And our faith needs to be strong in Jesus Christ, that He was the very Son of God. We can't be complacent. Let's turn over to 1 John chapter 4, verses 1 through 3. Beloved, believe not every spirit, but try the spirits, whether they are of God, because many false prophets are gone out into the world. We need to try the spirits. We need to see whether these things are coming from God or whether they're coming from Satan to lead us away. Hereby know ye the Spirit of God. Every spirit that confesseth that Jesus Christ is come in the flesh is of God. And when Jesus talks about Jesus Christ coming in the flesh, it's not coming as a man. It's coming as the Son of God. Coming of a virgin birth. That He died on the cross for our sins. And every spirit that confesseth not that Jesus Christ is come in the flesh is not of God. And this is that spirit of Antichrist. Wherefore ye have heard that it should come, and even now already is in the world this Antichrist. You look under Strong's, it says Antichrist. It says an opponent of the Messiah. It is someone that is against Christ. Someone who opposes the doctrine of Christ. These things that I've been reading, Antichrist. It's against the divine nature of Christ. These things are, they're quite appalling. Let's turn over to 2 John chapter 7, or verse 7. For many deceivers are entered into the world who confess not that Jesus Christ is come in the flesh. This is a deceiver and an antichrist. Look to yourselves that we lose not those things which we have wrought, but that we receive a full reward. Whosoever transgresseth and abideth not in the doctrine of Christ hath not God. He that abideth in the doctrine of Christ, he hath both the Father and the Son. If there come any unto you and bring not this doctrine, receive him not into your house, neither bid him Godspeed. For he that abideth For he that biddeth him Godspeed is partaker of his evil deeds. And when we wish somebody Godspeed, it's wishing them good fortune or success or may God prosper you. But let's see who these people are. These people that come unto you and don't have this doctrine of Christ. They have evil teachings. We need to be aware of them. Be watchful for them. It says, don't let them into your house. Don't let them into our spiritual house or our physical house. Because if we do, a warning. It's a warning to us. When we allow these things to come in, we've opened that door again for Satan. Let's look at Matthew chapter 13. Verses 24 to 30. I told my wife that this was going to be a sermonette today. I've told her that before, but it never seems to work out that way. I don't try to preach long. It just seems to be the way it works out. The parable of the tares. Another parable put he forth unto them, saying, the kingdom of heaven is likened unto a man which sowed good seed in his field. And while men slept, his enemy came and sowed tares among the wheat and went his way. And when the blade was sprung up and brought forth fruit, then appeared the tares also. So the servants of the householder came and said unto him, sir, didst not thou sow good seed in thy field? From whence then hath it tares? He said unto them, an enemy hath done this. The servants said unto him, wilt thou then that we go and gather them up? But he said, nay, lest while ye gather up the tares, ye root up also the wheat with them. Let both grow together until the harvest, and in the time of harvest I will say to the reapers, gather ye together first the tares and bind them in bundles to burn them, and gather the wheat into my barn. These are Christ's words. The parable of the tares. Now let's read the interpretation. Let's go over to verse 36. Then Jesus sent the multitude away and went into the house, and his disciples came unto him, saying, declare unto us the parable of the tares of the field. He answered and said unto them, he that soweth the good seed is the Son of Man. Jesus Christ is sowing that good seed today. The field is the world. Everyone. Everywhere. The good seed are the children of the kingdom. But the tares are the children of the wicked one. Complete opposite, isn't it? The righteous and the wicked. That we talked about earlier. And therefore the tares are gathered and burned in the fire. So shall it be in the end of the world. Did I read verse 39? The enemy that sowed them is the devil. The harvest is the end of the world, and the reapers are the angels. As therefore the tares are gathered and burned in the fire, so shall it be in the end of the world. So we see that the tares, the wicked people, were gathered and destroyed. the Son of Man shall send forth his angels, and they shall gather out of his kingdom all things that offend and them which do iniquity, and shall cast them into a furnace of fire. There shall be wailing and gnashing of teeth. Then shall the righteous shine forth as a sun in the kingdom of their Father. Who hath ears to hear, let him hear. A warning, isn't it? A warning again. And we saw this happen in the past, haven't we? That the wicked were destroyed and the righteous were preserved. Let's go over to back to Matthew 24. Let's read verses 36 to 42. And we skip some of this, but it talks, we read through 24, but if you read in there, it talks about the coming of Christ. And, it, you know, it talks about exactly what that will look like, the signs in the heaven and the actual return of Christ. But verse 36 says, "But of that day and hour no man knoweth, no, not the angels of heaven, but my Father only. But as in the days of Noah, which is Noah, were, so shall also the coming of man be. For in the days that were before the flood, they were eating and drinking and marrying and giving in marriage until the day that Noah entered into the ark." They were being complacent, weren't they? "And knew not until the flood came and took them all away. So shall also the coming of the Son of Man be. And then shall two be in the field, the one shall be taken and the other left. Two women shall be grinding at the mill, the one shall be taken and the other left. Watch therefore, for ye know not the hour your Lord doth come." We're to be watchful, we're to be on guard at all times. And you notice here this verse 40 and 41. It says, "There'll be two in the field, one shall be taken and the other left. Two shall be grinding at the mill, the one shall be taken and the other left." This is one of the scriptures that they use for the rapture. They're saying that the one that's taken is the one that's raptured away. But as we read earlier in the parable of tares, it wasn't that way, was it? The wicked were destroyed. They were destroyed. And it left the righteous. And we see this example. This just follows where it talks about the flood. What happened there? The wicked were destroyed and the righteous were preserved. It's not talking about that the one that's taken is the righteous. The one that's taken is the wicked person, and they are destroyed. Like in the time of Noah. Mosiah chapter 11, verses 196 to 199. This is on page 289. And this is what will happen someday. "He will make himself manifest unto all. Yea, every knee shall bow and every tongue confess before him. Yea, even at the last day, when all men shall stand to be judged of him, then shall they confess that he is God. Then shall they confess who live without God in the world, and the judgment of an everlasting punishment is just upon them. And they shall quake and tremble and shrink beneath the glance of an all-searching eye." Someday, every knee shall bow to our Lord and Savior. No matter what they're saying today, or the blasphemy against him today, someday they shall all kneel before him. In Mosiah chapter 1, verse 116, we read, "And moreover, I say unto you, that there shall be no other name given, nor any other way nor means whereby salvation can come unto the children of men, only in and through the name of Christ, the Lord omnipotent. This is the only way for salvation, is through Jesus Christ. And it's through Jesus Christ, who is the Son of God, who came down on this earth, was born of a virgin, and died on the cross for our sins. That's the Jesus Christ we are talking about. But so many today are trying to break that down, to say that he was not the Son of God, and all of these other things that we have read. Deception. And it is deceiving many in this world today. Many who are not strong in faith. And it is my prayer that each one of us in our spiritual lives, that we will be awake, we will be alert to these deceptions. And we're going to see more of them as time goes on. That we might remain strong, that we might be able to spend eternity with our Lord and Savior. Thank you.